Welcome back to Bob Edwards Weekend, produced by XM Satellite Radio and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. In an intense fight for the White House, Senator John McCain and Governor Sarah Palin have repeated accusations against the activist group ACORN of registering false voters.
We need to know the full extent of Senator Obama's relationship with ACORN, who is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying a fabric of democracy.
ACORN has defended itself, explaining that there would be minimal impact of a few workers turning in voter registration cards with false information, that even if a fake registration was accepted with the name of, say, Mickey Mouse, Mickey Mouse wouldn't actually show up to vote on Election Day. It's hard to forget the subject of voter disenfranchisement, which was such a big issue in the last two presidential elections. In 2000, when hanging chads created ballot confusion, the Supreme Court decided to halt the Florida recount, and in 2004, Ohio ballots and records were illegally destroyed in 56 of 88 counties, preventing a proper vote count. This year, a new lawsuit jeopardized the fate of thousands of Ohio votes. This time, Republicans sued the Democratic Secretary of State, challenging the 660,000 new voters who have registered since January. A lower court ruled in favor of the state's Republicans, but just last Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned that ruling, allowing the registrations to stand. Republicans are challenging voter registrations in several swing states leading up to this election, and Stephen Rosenfeld has been tracking those. Rosenfeld co-authored What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election, and reports on the issue for alternet.org. In August, you wrote an article outlining seven ways that American votes might not count in November, the first one being voter purges. Tell me about that.
Well, voter purging, this is really interesting. As you know, you register to vote, and you get put on these voter lists. And if you move, or if you die, or if you're convicted of a felony, you know, states and counties will want to remove you because it's just, you know, a good management practice. What happens with purging is that it can be done in a political manner. So, for instance, in Ohio in 2004, there was a lot of purges of voters in the big cities that were known to be likely Democratic strongholds, and there was no purging in the countryside, which was largely going to vote Republican. Then that became a problem to some people because they thought that there were these high turnout numbers reported from the rural areas that didn't match the cities, and they were wondering if people were messing with the counts and all. So anyway, fast forward to today. With purging, there are some new factors. Every state has to now, under federal law, has to create statewide voter databases. And what they're doing is, in certain states, they're comparing those lists with Social Security numbers and with driver's licenses databases. And if a name appears in duplicate or if something is misspelled, depending on the state, you can be purged. You can be removed from voter rolls. And the problem with that, apart from the fact that this is largely done in secret and nobody really knows about it until they show up at the very last minute, is that all this new data is enabling certain states. And so who are these states? We're talking about Michigan. We're talking about Kansas. We're talking about Louisiana. We're talking about New Jersey. All of these states may not be following pre-existing civil rights laws that say you have to follow a four-year process before you can remove somebody from a list. And, you know, in an election, everything has partisan overtones. So the question is, are voters being purged improperly? Now, for example, in Wisconsin, the attorney general, who is a Republican, is saying that the state election board must compare the voter rolls with Social Security database. And if typos don't match or if names are misspelled, you know, they have to be removed from voter rolls. Apart from creating an incredible bureaucratic nightmare on top of perhaps the busiest time in years because there are all these new registrations that are being processed, the Social Security Administration's database has tons of errors. Academics will tell you that 20 to 30% of the names or fields can be wrong. So you have these last-minute actions or activities or threats, and this gets to litigation, where the bottom line is, some people may end up showing up on Election Day to vote and being told they're not on the list. and they won't know it until that time.
Louisiana tried to purge hurricane refugees.
Yeah, they did. Louisiana, when people had to leave because of Katrina, Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, they left with literally the clothes on their back. Many people then didn't even have a photo ID. So when they got to a neighboring state, one of the first things they did was they went down to motor vehicles and got a driver's license. Well, in some of those states, if you get a driver's license, you're asked if you want to register to vote. In some states, you're automatically registered, even though people may not have known it at the time. Louisiana then, in comparing driver's license databases with neighboring states, if they found that people had more recent driver's licenses with the same name, they purged those people off the voter lists, regardless of whether or not those Katrina refugees wanted to return to Louisiana. Now, because New Orleans is such an African-American majority city, this has big political implications because most of the voters who were purged were African-Americans. It helps elect a Republican as governor and you know, in their legislatures and all. Now, what's really interesting about this is that it violates the federal National Voter Registration Act because they're just going out and doing the purge without following this process of trying to contact voters over two federal election cycles, which is 4 years, and without getting into more details. And when I call the Secretary of State's office, their whole attitude is, it's our state, it's our law, we think we're doing what's right, and you know, so what about this federal law? And the so what piece about the federal law takes you to the Justice Department, where you would expect if somebody or certain states or jurisdictions, you know, were not following federal voting rights laws, that they would step in and initiate an enforcement action. But this was just an example of many, many issues at the Justice Department where they just decided not to enforce. And the non-enforcement or selective enforcement has partisan overtones just as much as many other things at the Justice Department. So it's quite a story in Louisiana, and it's ongoing.
Isn't that what happened in Michigan?
In Michigan, it was a little bit different. What happened in Michigan, it was a little more deceitful, actually. The Secretary of State there, she sent out this mailing to voters that was more of like a welcome to the system. You know, here's like some local election information. If you have questions, call your, you know, it was sort of like a good guy type of postcard. And if those were returned, that initiated the first stage in the purging process. It didn't say that these postcards are going to be used, you know, are notifying you that, you know, your status as a voter may be changing. So that's what was eyebrow-raising there. And people have gone to court over this, by the way, although this kind of litigation, which always happens before an election, never gets settled until after Election Day.
I'm talking to Stephen Rosenfeld, who's been tracking voter suppression leading up to this year's presidential election. In March, Rosenfeld wrote about a 69-year-old African-American city council member from Texarkana, Texas, who now has a criminal record after she and her granddaughter helped homebound senior citizens complete absentee ballots.
There's fine print in recent Texas law where if you actually, as a neighbor, go to help another neighbor vote, or go into a senior center and help somebody fill out an absentee ballot, if you don't write your name on the back of that ballot and you carry it to a mailbox, it's considered a misdemeanor. And if you do like five or six or more, it's considered a felony. So what was happening, especially in like Latino neighborhoods and African American neighborhoods, where you had, you know, people who had been were known as, you know, church people and community leaders and stuff like that, who really made it part of their sort of like civic identity, you know, to help the more frail or infirm people go out and vote, they basically were just stopped because they were afraid that if they did something wrong, they would be prosecuted. And the state's attorney general was prosecuted. Well, that went to court, and most of that law was challenge, and there was a settlement on the courthouse steps in Marshall, Texas, which is the northeastern part of the state. And it was supposed to suspend that practice for the rest of this campaign. Well, it's not entirely suspended without going into the fine print. So what happens is that has a real chilling effect on, you know, the whole people-to-people aspect of campaigns. The other thing that's happening in Texas most recently is that the McCain campaign has sent out these fundraising letters. They've also done it in Ohio and Florida that are A lot of people think they're being used to draw up voter challenge lists, and that's really curious because they're sending out these letters to Democratic voters, and if they don't get responses or if they get returned because they say do not forward on them, they're, again, the thinking is they're identifying people who don't live at the addresses on their registrations. It doesn't matter if the U.S. mail messes up or anything like that. You would think that a fundraising mailing would not have a return to sender, do not forward thing on it, because you want to get it to the intended recipient to raise money. So, again, it remains to be seen how this is going to play out, but it looks like this is what's being done to draw up voter challenge lists in Ohio, Florida, and Texas. It's not as if they're just seeking to knock off one or two voters, because what you end up doing is you end up pulling someone out in line, slowing down the operation of hundreds, enabling hundreds of people to vote at a time. And that is sort of the bigger picture here that gets, you know, we shouldn't forget in all this minutia.
Can't always be Democrats that are the victims of these tactics.
Well, that is true. I can give you some examples where Democrats did some stuff like this, but to be fair about this, most of these are coming from the Republican side of the aisle aimed at likely Democratic voters. Here's a Democratic example. You know, to be fair, recently there was a recount in Washington State. I'm not sure if it was 2004 or 2006. And what it came down to there was counting something called provisional ballots, which is if you show up at a polling place and your name's not on a voter list, you'll be given another ballot called a provisional ballot, where you will be asked, the election officials will subsequently try to verify that, you know, your address is right and you were registered. Well, it turns out that the candidate who became the Democratic governor was successful in going to court and stopping the provisional ballot recount at a point where she was able to be like the winner, almost a version of what happened in Florida in 2000. But, you know, the thing about this, Bob, it's really, really interesting. Most of these tactics actually were developed by Democrats, but they were developed by Democrats in the pre-segregation, pre-civil rights era South, when the Democrats were in the majority, when they were the governing class, and where they didn't want to have African Americans voting. What happened after the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act passed was Republicans essentially shifted over and adopted many of their tactics to basically appeal to the, you know, the white Southern voters. It was, you know, Lyndon Johnson famously told Bill Moyers when he signed the Voting Rights Act, you know, I just signed away the South. And what's happened since then is over the years, the Republicans have adopted these same kinds of tactics in different ways. For instance, the way we hear about it now is the Republicans like to talk about voter fraud, as if there are tons of Democrats who are willing to pose as imposters and vote more than once or twice. And to be sure, there are examples of people individually doing this every now and then across the country. You know, we're a country of hundreds of millions of people. People do dumb things like this. But the response has been to basically overregulate the election process on a statewide level out of, you know, fear that this could be happening. So to be honest about this, most of the challenges, if you take a look, you know, read the papers and you'll see they're not coming from Democrats against Republicans. They're coming from the other side against what they consider to be the new and likely swing voters in the swing states.
What about 2006? Didn't hear a lot of complaints about election fraud there. Maybe things are getting better.
Well, you ask a very, very, very intriguing question. In 2006, many of the election integrity activists who were really worried about the vote, especially electronic vote counts, got very, very quiet on election night when the Democrats took both houses of Congress. And it may not be politically correct for me to say this, but the truth is a lot of the people who are working on election integrity issues are more sympathetic to the left than the right. They just sat on their hands. And interestingly enough, they were encouraged to some extent to do so by the Democratic Party because, for instance, there were problems with electronic voting in central Pennsylvania. And Rick Santorum, who was a very hard right senator, very, you know, pro-life and everything like that, he raised legitimate questions. But I only know of one group from like an election integrity from that you know, universe, who said, you know, these are legitimate concerns. And because people did not want to question, you know, the Democratic takeover to some extent. On the other hand, it cut the other way as well. There was a race in Columbus, Ohio, where I was told about, where the Republican incumbent was reelected after a number of provisional ballots from college students were disqualified. And the Democrats didn't want to fight on behalf of those college students. And they could have gained another seat in the House, perhaps, if they did. The thing that's interesting about this dynamic is that I see it happening right now. And what I mean by that is Democrats think they're going to get the White House. So they have an institutional bias, if you will, against talking about election problems because, one, they don't want to scare off new voters. And two, if Obama wins, they don't want to question the accuracy of the count. Now, maybe that's smart politics, but what's also happening is there are all these stories popping up around the country about vote counting problems, this, early voting, that, threats or potential threats to challenge voters and accusations of voter fraud and everything like that. The Democratic Party and the DNC has been utterly silent on all of these. And the Democrats have unprecedented resources right now in terms of manpower and money. And they basically know what they can do. They can't stop everyone from cheating every which way, but there are things they can do to be more present and serve as a check or a balance. And my reporting has told me that they have not yet made a commitment to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Rosenfeld is a senior fellow at alternet.org and co-author of What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election. His most recent book, Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting, provides state-by-state voter requirements and election concerns.